You are Locked On Ravens, your daily Baltimore Ravens podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
And we return here with another episode of Locked On Ravens. Kevin Ostreicher, your host, here with Spencer Schultz of Baltimore Beatdown for another Taco Tuesday edition episode. And Spencer, even though we're just a couple of weeks until free agency, that does not mean we do not have any content to talk about. We're going to talk about the Ravens drama that happened over the past week, some more Pro Bowl prospect portfolio things that you've gotten into, and then obviously a mini free agency preview with that being on the horizon. How are you doing today?
Doing very well. We are still in the dead zone before free agency, before the draft. So just getting after it, trying to scout some prospects. This week did the edge rushers. I'm not completely finished. I will be on the Baltimore Beatdown podcast on Thursday talking fully. I'll be finished by then. I still have a couple more to go through, a couple guys to kind of finish up on. But it's a fun time, a relaxing time. And, you know, some J.J. Watt news comes out today amidst a little disinformation about a fake Peloton. Because that is what season, that's what part of the offseason we have now reached. So it is the liar's lunch, the disinformation season, and that's where we are.
Yeah, J.J. Watt going to the Arizona Cardinals after apparently his Peloton lied to everyone and said that he was either going to Green Bay, Cleveland, or Buffalo. Now, J.J. Watt did clear that up by saying he does not have a bike, but nonetheless, J.J. Watt goes out of the AFC to the Arizona Cardinals. But Spencer, the Ravens had some drama last week with a couple of players who are set to hit free agency. And so let's start off with the two wide receivers in Willie Snead and Dez Bryant. Now, Willie Snead posted on Twitter a comment about having wide receivers be number ones in certain systems and the rest is up to them. And then Dez Bryant posts a bunch of things in response to fans and pretty much says that he enjoyed his time in Baltimore. He's grateful for it, but he quickly realized that Baltimore was not the fit for him, among some other things as well, talking about his chemistry with Lamar Jackson. And obviously, this sent Ravens Twitter into a frenzy, talking about how Willie Snead was talking about number one wide receivers, saying the Ravens system isn't good enough to have a number one wide receiver. This is a PR nightmare. With Dez Bryant's comments, it became the Ravens can't retain any wide receivers. Their pass offense is broken. What did you make about these comments and what they actually do say about the Baltimore Ravens and their passing offense in particular?
Well, the first thing that I thought was perhaps Willie Snead and Dez Bryant were had some conversations with Eric DaCosta and the Ravens front office and probably said, you know, thank you for your service. Thank you for what you've done. Willie Snead, a great Raven, had a nice little tenure here in Baltimore, but feels like the Ravens are moving on. They did draft Devin Duvernay last year, who is equipped to play best in the slot. And it felt like they gave him a ramp-up year and some idea of how to play that move kind of H role that Willie Snead had played. So it feels like they'll go with Duvernay. And then Dez Bryant, you know, kind of reluctantly was signed by the Ravens. It almost felt like that the Ravens got in contact and Dez Bryant really wanted a shot there and wanted to come play with Lamar Jackson maybe and has the workout happen in the offseason. And the Ravens kind of turned him down, maybe offered him a practice squad job and our practice squad spot, and he wasn't willing to take that. And then he is willing to later as no one else really gave him an offer that was any better. So he comes to Baltimore and, you know, everyone knows what happened throughout the season with those two. But I think it just kind of showed that Willie Snead feels like any receiver can be a number one receiver at the NFL level. And there kind of is truth to that. It feels like that a lot of guys need the right, you put them with the perfect situation. There are perfect fits around the NFL. Guys that fit really well. You know, Michael Thomas might not have been as successful in another offense as a young receiver as he was in the Saints offense with Drew Brees, who was so accurate and so precise underneath. It really accentuated some of Michael Thomas's skills. And while I think that Michael Thomas is a really well-rounded receiver and had dominant production, maybe he wouldn't have performed as well on the Jaguars if he was drafted by the Jaguars. Maybe he wouldn't have the big contract that he has and things like that. So I don't, there's guys that isn't true of. There's some receivers that might be 5'7" and 180 pounds and not quite big enough to hold up and things like that. So I think there's a little bit of truth to it. Snead, had good production in New Orleans, speaking of New Orleans. And I think that it does go to show different situations have different results. And I think a key part of his original tweet was saying that once you're in the right situation, the rest is on you. Basically saying your work ethic, your principles, your ability to stay confident, stay ready, to train hard, to pay attention in meetings, be a professional, that's on you. And I think that part got overlooked a little bit. But ultimately, it felt like the Ravens didn't want to bring those guys back. As far as the Ravens passing game, you know, there's some issues with it for sure. They don't incorporate enough screens. They don't throw the ball enough to really catch rhythm at times. They're a heavy running offense. But I think that some of those problems are overstated. And a lot of people want to call the Ravens offense, passing offense, the worst in the NFL because of yards. But it's not. In terms of efficiency and DVOA, in terms of whatever you want to look at, if you want to look at WAR, if you want to look at EPA, if you want to look at simply watching football and realizing that the New York Jets did not have a better passing game than the Baltimore Ravens throughout the season, that the Chicago Bears did not. I mean, there's a litany of teams that were extremely unsuccessful throwing the ball this past year. And then to go ahead and say that Baltimore's was the worst is a little bit peculiar, considering how efficient they can be. I think they were middle of the pack this year. They were a lot better the year before, but no veterans. That's what I always come back to. When you look at this offense, there were no veterans. You had Nick Boyle, who was on his second contract. You had Mark Ingram, who was on his third contract and was kind of relegated into a minor role, despite, you know, what he can do. He is a running back at the same time and one that wasn't on the field. So those are the two guys. Other than that, it's, you know, Mark Andrews, rookie contract, Marquise Brown, all these different guys. Willie Snead, I guess, was the other one that slipped my mind. So Willie Snead, one of the few veterans there. And Willie Snead had a somewhat prominent role through that middle of the season. Willie Snead was the Ravens' number one receiver. Again, in that Patriots game, he was the only one that really came to play. The middle of the season saw some ups and downs from Mark Andrews and Hollywood Brown, but you know, three veteran options on your entire offense, your passing game is not going to be prioritized. And I think that you can sense that from Dez Bryant's comments saying that the offense can't be learned overnight, that it takes chemistry, it takes time. And let's go back and think about that. You know, everybody loves to talk about the Ravens Super Bowl run in 2012-2013 season. And think about Anquan Boldin and the level that him and Joe Flacco were playing at. That took a couple years. That was their third year together. That was the end of their third year. Two veterans at that point. Well, I guess Flacco was on his rookie contract, but at the end of it. And Anquan Boldin, a proven, you know, 100 reception, 1,000 plus yard receiver several times in Arizona. And then in his third year being 29, 30 years old in Baltimore. And that had chemistry. They finally had the chemistry to be dominant in the air. The air game, the passing game requires time, practice, consideration, learning, growth, simply seeing different looks that different teams give you over the years. And, you know, Lamar Jackson was on year 2.5 with Mark Andrews. They had a good connection, but Mark Andrews kind of gets taken away, had some drops as well. And Marquise Brown's in year two and not, you know, the typical X receiver that you see. So I think there's a lot of youth. I think they're still making a lot of mistakes. And people want to talk about the passing game and the limitations of the play calling and some of those other things. And there is definite truth to it. Like I mentioned, I think that screens would help out a lot more, getting the ball in guys' hands, throwing some screens to Miles Boykin once in a while, the guy who had problems halfway through the year against the Philadelphia Eagles. He admitted that he ran out of a huddle without knowing what the play call was. And the play call was a goal line back shoulder fade to none other than Miles Boykin. And that shows youth, that shows counting on these youngsters to play heavy roles in this passing offense that doesn't throw the ball a ton. And that wasn't a recipe for success. And again, Anquan Boldin, a guy that's the exact prototype of a receiver that the Ravens are currently lacking on their roster. If you go back and watch, you know, his postseason run, the balls he was able to bring in for Joe Flacco, the chemistry that they had, and then realize that he was an 800, 900 yard receiver in Baltimore. That was catching, you know, 4, 5, 6 touchdowns, but didn't matter. They were winning. He was getting closer to winning a Super Bowl on a really great team that was loaded with talent. And the Ravens have made these postseason runs a couple of years, and it feels like they're a couple pieces away. So, you know, if you pay a guy equal, I would think they would want to go to the proven winner and catch, you know, 15 less balls. I don't think catching 15 passes more or less is the difference between someone wanting to play somewhere or not. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but at the end of the day, just up to personal preference, and people want to talk about this and talk about that, but get some more veterans on that offense and see how things go.
Yeah, I certainly think that the Ravens do need some more veterans on that offense, even in the wide receiver room, because you had Willie Snead and you had Dez Bryant, and everybody's talking about taking all these different wide receivers, but where do they fit in on the roster? Do the Ravens go into the 2021 season with all of their receivers, all six of them, because I assume they keep six, being in their third year or less? The Ravens need some veterans on this offense for sure. But Spencer, That drama was not the only drama the Ravens had last week, as Matthew Judon was a little upset at a report that ESPN reporter Jameson Hensley put out about the Ravens offering him a contract in the $16.5 million range in the 2020 season during the season. And then ultimately, Matthew Judon went on to Twitter, went on to Instagram, and what was threatening to release pictures of Jameson Hensley at a strip club and things about him cheating on his wife. Kind of something you would expect one of those parody Twitter accounts to make up, but no, this was a real situation, and obviously this is not the first time that something false has been reported about Matthew Judon and his contract demands, so I think he was a bit frustrated with the way that this played out. But what were your overall thoughts and takeaways from that whole situation, Spencer?
Well, my first reaction was that, you know, knowing Matt Judon over the last couple of years, as his presence in the locker room and what he said to the media and some of the different things, he's been a prankster, he's been a bully, he's been a guy that likes to joke around, that likes to dance and goof off and mess around with his teammates and things like that. So I think a lot of people understood that that's where Judon comes from, and that, you know, at first it's he's going eye for an eye. You're going to make things up about me, I'll make things up about you. It's a two-way street. But then you think about people who don't know who Matt Judon is. You think about maybe a Green Bay Packers journalist or fan or someone who follows the Seahawks or covers the Seahawks out in Seattle. They're not going to know Matt Judon's personality. He's not, you know, a premier player in the NFL. They're not going to know that he is someone very light and who does things like that and talks that way and things like that. So it's going to be taken very differently and received very differently. I think that it was taken a little bit too seriously for sure. But at the same time, people don't respond to things like that well. Some people handle things differently. It kind of reminds me of Kanye West at the VMAs a few years back. You know, jumping up on stage and stealing Taylor Swift's moment. And, you know, Taylor Swift could have responded very differently to that. She could have immediately responded with, well, you know, Beyonce had a great music video, but I won. So there you have it, Kanye, or something like that. I think it would have been hilarious if Jameson Hensley would have been like, well, Matt, you know, I do love the lemon pepper wings at Magic City, something like that. But maybe that's not who he is. I don't know Jameson Hensley that well personally. And he might not have found that very funny. He might have been offended. That might have been something that upset him very much so. And I think that Judon's frustration did turn into something negative in that sense. But at the same time, it was taken a little bit too seriously. It was the second time. It was Jameson Hensley, you know, who did report that Matt Judon wanted $20 million. Matt Judon said that's not true. And then says that Judon turned down a deal that was impossible to talk about during the middle of the season. So that couldn't have been true. And it wouldn't have made sense, as Judon said, because it would have either meant that his agent leaked it, in which sense he wouldn't be lying about it, or that the Ravens broke league rules and the Ravens wouldn't tell him themselves for doing that. Then Hensley goes back and alters the story. So it's a tough situation. It's difficult. I think Judon, you know, made a joke and some people didn't like it and took it quite seriously. I can kind of understand why, but I also understand why Judon was frustrated. Maybe the best situation would have been to have a sit down and talk about what he does want in free agency or what is going on. But Judon doesn't seem to want to do that. So it's a tough situation. Jason LaConfora of CBS Sports and 105.7 The Fan Baltimore then goes on a tirade immediately following that situation that day on the radio about how the Ravens coaches want Matt Judon franchise tagged at $20 million, that if Calais Campbell is worth $15 million, then Matt Judon is worth $20 to their defense, and that they want Judon back. And Jason LaConfora has been hit or miss. He's been hitting a lot lately, but for in terms of what makes sense, Judon hasn't, you know, done the classic thing where an athlete deletes all of their social media posts of their previous team when they know that they're not coming back or that team told them, you know, best of luck, we're not going to be able to give you what you want. So it kind of feels like the Ravens have been playing the waiting game, trying to see exactly what that cap comes in at, what's going to happen. There has been a bunch of indecision by the league. You know, for instance, Leonard Williams is going to be franchise tagged, but he filed a grievance to he wants to be considered a defensive end, so he makes an extra $1 million, and the Giants wanted to franchise tag him as a defensive tackle. Usually those are pretty quick decisions, but in this uncertain time due to COVID and this uncertain salary cap situation that we have, that hasn't happened yet. So, you know, it seems like people are biding time, getting a little bit antsy, and that was kind of the product of it. It felt like that Judon is in a weird place right now and didn't like a second rumor coming out within a month from the same reporter. So he lashed out a little bit, but there was truth to the lash out. There's definite understanding to both sides that Judon maybe did take it a little bit too far. You can see why some people would think that. And you can also see why Matt Judon is upset at the same time. So it is what it is. It was kind of funny, kind of people to some rub some people the wrong way, and it created some headlines. So just another slow week during the off season when there's not a lot of news going on. Otherwise, that might have got kind of gotten brushed under the radar, but here we are.
Yeah, and hopefully in the coming weeks here, the Ravens do make some signings and get some guys back in Baltimore who were on the team in 2020. And hopefully this stuff doesn't become the big blow-up that it definitely was at this point in the offseason. But we're going to head into our first break now. And when we return, we'll be getting into a bit of a mini free agency preview. So stay tuned for that, and we'll be right back. BetOnline is the fastest and easiest way to bet on all your sports action. Football might be over, but the NBA, college basketball, and the NHL are in full swing. BetOnline even covers awards, TV shows, and reality TV. There are real-time updated odds and props on almost anything you can imagine. BetOnline has you covered for all the news, scores, and odds. It's the best way to place your bets, and it's free to sign up. Head to the website or use your mobile device to sign up today and receive your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts. And we return here with our second segment of this Taco Tuesday edition of Locked On Ravens. Kevin Ostreicher, your host, still here with Spencer Schultz. And Spencer, now getting into a mini free agency preview, I want to start off with a target that's been linked to the Ravens on multiple occasions, and that is wide receiver Corey Davis of the Tennessee Titans. Davis had 65 receptions for 984 yards and 5 touchdowns. In 2020, he averaged 15.1 yards per catch. And Davis seems like the type of receiver that the Ravens need. Big, physical, fast. He's 6'3", 209 pounds. But throughout some Ravens channels, there have been mixed responses to the idea of adding Corey Davis to the Ravens. So, Spencer, what's your opinion on the fit that Corey Davis is on this Baltimore roster as it stands right now? And also the fit that he has on this roster based off of what he could demand on the open market?
Well, there's a lot of varied opinions, and Davis has not even hit free agency yet. We are not into the new league year. Extension could be on the table. Franchise tag could be on the table until March 13th, and we've still got some time. So ultimately, we're unsure of what's going to happen. But to me, Corey Davis is a guy coming out of Western Michigan who, big, tall, fast, separated, big catch radius, sticky hands, created after the catch a good bit. And blocked really well. He was a kind of a rising star. He was coached under PJ Fleck at Western Michigan, who then became Minnesota's head coach. A player very similar I see in this draft class is Rashad Bateman. I think has a very similar profile and similar skill set to Davis. Davis comes into the NFL. He is in a somewhat inept Titans passing offense with Marcus Mariota being injured here and there and kind of not playing quite the same as he did over his first 2 years as Davis gets into his second and third year. And finally, Ryan Tannehill's inserted into the lineup. But when I put on the tape and watched what Corey Davis kind of did, I've gone through the first five games of the season at this point, and he looks to be what the Ravens lack and what they wanted Miles Boykin to be, which is a possession receiver that can separate as well, that is tough over the middle of the football field. Corey Davis had 3 drops. He catches a lot of tough footballs when he is contested over the middle of the field. The other interesting statistic that I found when just kind of doing some background on Corey Davis was that Corey Davis was targeted more when the Titans were trailing with 51 targets and similar production than A.J. Brown. So everyone wants to say, oh, A.J. Brown is the number one, but A.J. Brown didn't get a bunch of more targets or anything of the sort. A.J. Brown is just very dangerous after the catch, more so than Davis. Brown is one of the best, if not the best, after the catch yak receivers in the NFL. Davis is not quite that. He can create after the catch. He's got some speed to him, and he can break some tackles here and there, but that's not really his forte. But I saw him separating against single coverage, making contested catches. I see him as a red zone threat, a guy who can go up and get the ball and uses his frame well. He can catch along the sideline. He has great boundary body control and has really long arms, big wingspan, so he can catch some balls that are maybe a little inaccurate and away from his frame and shields the ball while doing so. And that's what the Ravens are missing. They're missing consistent hands. They're missing someone who can make tough catches over the middle of the football field. Aside from Mark Andrews, who has had drop issues, put simply, he has over his last 2 years. He has, dropped some easy catches and really not been a huge contested catch guy necessarily. Like he's a tight window guy, but not really like a physical catcher. And it feels like that's what the Ravens have missed. And it feels like Davis presents exactly that. In terms of what he would get on the open market, He's 26 years old, coming off of a really great season. Robbie Anderson got 1 year, $10 million last year, coming off of a, you know, not so great season, with some highlights and low moments. And that was at a higher cap figure. So you've got to think that Davis is going to be above $10 million a year. You got to think he's a guy that I would be willing to pay, you know, $14, $15, $16, maybe $17 million per year if the Ravens wanted to give him, you know, $15 million a year for 4 years and have those last 2 years be kind of voidable years where they could get rid of him and have a little bit of dead money, but not a lot, and have a low first year cap hit in this decreased cap year. We still don't know what the cap is exactly, but feels like it's going to be in that $185, $188 million range. And if the Ravens wanted to offer him, you know, $60 million over 4 years and give him a $5-6 million cap hit this year, that would make a lot of sense. It would fill in for Davis, his ability to be an ISO receiver in heavy formations that can separate and make tough catches over the middle. That is what the Ravens lacked. Miles Boykin was out there a lot, but as we discussed last segment, Boykin not on the same page with Lamar Jackson and hasn't been the consistent, reliable target that they wanted him to be. Last year, it feels like the Ravens put a lot of chips into Boykin being a guy that takes a great leap, that progresses a ton, improves, and becomes a staple in the offense. And that didn't happen. And it's not to say that that can't happen this year, but do you really want to rely on that being the occurrence again for the second straight year and set yourself up for disappointment? Or maybe do you want to overcompensate? And when the Ravens did bring in Dez Bryant, it put a little bit of pressure on Boykin. I think he responded well down the stretch. So bringing in Davis can't hurt. I think it can only help. The Ravens don't have another big, strong receiver like Boykin. And Boykin doesn't really play that way from what we've seen. He's more of a point forward. So I think that Davis would bring a physical, contested catch, strong hands, middle of the field, willingness to take hits, and brings the ball down regardless. Kind of guy that can also, as Ravens fans should know from what he did to Marcus Peters, and I believe it was that week 11 loss, can hit double moves. He can run pokos, post corners, and sluggos, and all kinds of things, and he's a weapon deep. So to me, Davis is a really valuable receiver with a great skill set. He doesn't drop a lot of footballs. He can separate. He has a big catch radius, and he's fast and can win down the field. So there's a lot of production concerns about Davis, but you scout traits, and he has some production from last year with Tannehill throwing him accurate passes and giving him some confidence. He looked great. So, you know, the Titans were a run-first offense. Didn't see Corey Davis complaining about targets. He's an outstanding blocker as well, a really dynamic blocker. Being able to put him and Boykin on the field together would create mismatches in the run game as blockers, as two of the literal best blocking wide receivers in the NFL. So I think that Corey Davis would be a great fit for the Ravens.
Yeah, Davis is someone who I am all on board with the Ravens getting. His skill set is something that the Ravens badly need. And I think that with his age and everything that he brings to the table, he fits the Ravens timeline as well. But Spencer, someone who is currently on the Ravens roster, who there is a bit of a dilemma and a debate with among a lot of people as to whether he should be on the roster in 2021, is Brandon Williams. Someone who has been an amazing Raven over the course of his career in the NFL, but he is getting up there in age. The Ravens could save some money by cutting him. How do you see the situation with Brandon Williams playing out? Do you see him in a Ravens uniform in 2021? Do you think the Ravens should release him? What's your take on the whole Brandon Williams situation?
I don't think that the Ravens are going to let Brandon Williams go, but I think that they should consider it and ultimately should. The reason being, let me address first the primary rebuttal that people tend to have, or the other side of the spectrum, is that, well, look at what happens when the Ravens don't have Brandon Williams in. I hear that. I see that. Number one, though, Brandon Williams was active, healthy, and played against the Titans in that playoff loss in 2020, in that divisional round home loss. He was there. The Ravens got run all over regardless. So then people want to go look at it and say that in the 2020 regular season, they didn't have Williams, and then they had him against the Titans, and look at what happened. But they also didn't have Calais Campbell. And Calais Campbell, to me, made a much greater impact in that Titans game, as well as the fact, moving forward, is that he's not worth $7 million. And his cap hit is $15 million this year, but about eight of that is already done, no matter what. That's dead cap if you cut him. So the question then becomes, is Brandon Williams worth $7 million? And to me, the answer is no. He is a one-and-a-half down player. He does not rush the passer. And the reason that people, you know, think that the Ravens need him so badly is because they haven't had an adequate replacement or depth. You know, Justin Ellis, not very strong against the, you know, the run or the pass, a kind of career backup guy who is going to be a career backup guy, not really dynamic as a defensive football player. He's quality depth at best. And, you know, the Ravens did have Michael Pierce, who came in out of shape and ended up opting out. And Lord only knows, you know, what his situation is going to be. But Michael Pierce was really disappointing as well. So with that $7 million, can you go sign a Dalvin Tomlinson, who is an improvement as a pass rusher, someone who's hitting the free agent market? Shelby Harris, another dominant run stuffer who is hitting the free agent market, who also rushes the passer, gets sacks, bats balls down, can be on the field on third down. Can you draft someone higher because you've cut Brandon Williams? Can you go, you know, sign a couple of players for that and provide some more quality depth and insurance? You know, if you keep Brandon Williams and he gets hurt, then you end up having a $15 million cap hit and you didn't save $7 million so that you can have a 1-2 down run stuffer who can't rush the passer. I just think that Brandon Williams I think he's a great Raven. Absolutely. He's had a ton of big moments. He's worked his tail off. He has been a voice in the locker room, and that's why I don't think the Ravens are going to let him go. They value those things very much, but in a business sense here, you're not getting bang for your buck. Over the cap has him valued at $800,000 a year. You can find run stuffers. You can fill that role. And I don't think Williams is a dominant three tech as we saw. Is he a dominant nose? Maybe a little bit, but I don't even think he's one of the, you know, the five best nose tackles in the NFL right now. He doesn't do the things that a Vita Vey does. There's a lot of more dynamic interior defensive players, and Brandon Williams has a cap hit like one that is making a ton of noise. Like, he has a cap hit like Calais Campbell, but isn't a factor against the passing game. You know, people want to say he pushes the pocket or something like that. You can't find someone who pushes the pocket for $1 million instead of $7 million. So to me, Brandon Williams is a great Raven, but someone that should absolutely be a cap casualty if it allows them to make moves in the offensive line, in, you know, grabbing a Corey Davis. Because, as I said, Corey Davis would have a first-year cap hit of $6 or $7 million. Would I rather have Corey Davis or Brandon Williams? The answer is going to be Corey Davis 10 times out of 10. So I think that's a way of creating money for the Ravens that would help them move out. And, you know, kind of the most basic way to look at it, which can oversimplify things, but something I like to look at is, again, teams have run on the Ravens when Brandon Williams is there, and the Ravens have not been successful in the playoffs with Brandon Williams there as well. He's been in Baltimore for quite some time. The Ravens have won, I believe, 2 playoff games in that time. Again, just not a three-down player and someone that should be commanding that much money on your cap.
Yeah, the Brandon Williams situation is certainly an interesting one. And for the Ravens, they could potentially go out and sign some players, as you mentioned, a couple of players for that money that Brandon Williams eventually, if he was cut, would save the Ravens. But we're going to head into our final break here. And when we return, we'll be getting into the latest edition of the Purple Prospect Portfolio. So stay tuned for that, and we'll be right back. With the ever-increasing numbers of makes and models, it's now impossible to stock all the parts you need into a traditional chain storefront. Why endure from pointless or seemingly intimidating questioning and wait while the counterman orders the parts on his computer, choosing only the brand his warehouse happens to carry? You have computers with access to rockauto.com at home and in your pocket. They have everything from engine control modules and brake parts to tail lamps, motor oil, and even new carpet. Whether it's for your classic or daily driver, get everything you need in a few easy clicks delivered directly to your door. Go to rockauto.com right now and see all the parts available for your car or truck. Right locked on in their how'd you hear about us box so they know we sent you. Amazing selection, reliably low prices, all the parts your car will ever need, rockauto.com. And we return here with our final segment of this Taco Tuesday edition of Locked On Ravens. Kevin Ostreicher still here with Spencer Schultz. And Spencer, the Purple Prospect Portfolio is returning here to the show once again. And this time, it seems like you've been looking at some edge players for the Ravens and just in general as well, their skill sets, what they could bring to an NFL roster. What have you seen out of some of the guys that you've looked at for this Purple Prospect Portfolio?
Well, some of the early round guys that I do really like. I'm going to start with Jalen Phillips, who was the number one recruit in the nation a few years ago and ended up going to UCLA. He had some concussion concerns and injuries and quite a bit of concussion. So he ends up retiring in 2018 temporarily, and then he ends up transferring, coming out of his mini retirement to the University of Miami, playing this past year. He was dominant. I think he is the best pure pass rusher in this class. He is a stout run defender as well, but his get-off, his IQ as a pass rusher, his ability to use lateral quickness, explosiveness, as well as incorporate his hands with stringing combinations of chops and rips and spins and different things is really strong. He is rarely out of place. He has great pursuit speed. He really checks all the boxes. I think he is a top 15 player in this class. I think that, you know, I don't have access to his medical history. I don't know how much concerns there are, and I'm not going to. So that's not something I can objectively look at other than speculate. So I'm just going to remove that. And if NFL teams find that it is much more severe than I would know, similar to what Terrell Lewis, you know, had some medical concerns and red flags, guy who was considered a first or second round player last year and ends up falling into the third round, but hey, ended up being somewhat productive for the Rams this past year. So I don't know the ins and outs of his medical situation, so I'm not going to pretend to. Moving past that, he reminds me of Myles Garrett. He looks similar to him style-wise, coming off the ball, similar size to me, the explosiveness. I see someone who can win all three ways. He can win around the arc with speed, ripping, or with get-off. He can rush through a pass rusher with a bull rush. He can push-pull. He can you know, generate movement and push the pocket if he wants to, as well as having inside counters. He can cross-chop inside. He can use hump moves. He can do different things inside. So just a really well-rounded pass rusher. And like I said, stout against the run as well. He bullies tight ends. I think that he could certainly be a stand-up guy as well as a guy that puts his hand into the ground. I think he would be best suited to be in a multiple front. And if the Ravens, you know, were comfortable with his medicals and some teams were not, that would be a Montez Sweat-like drop, it feels like, for someone. Well, Sweat's concerns were apparently completely frivolous and kind of a misdiagnosis, while Phillips are more serious. But I see Phillips being an impact player if the medicals clear out. So that's a big question for him. But completely dominant, put together good games against Clemson, against all opponents in an all-ACC schedule. So led the ACC in sacks. I believe he had 8.5. Great pass rusher, great player. And if there were no medical concerns for him, I don't see any reason why he wouldn't be getting, you know, mocked and considered as a top 10 possibility for teams who need pass rushers. The next one that I kind of just looked at for the second time, I looked at him about a month and a half ago, and then again today, actually, was Kwity Paye coming out of Michigan. Paye reminds me a little bit of Terrell Suggs, to be honest, in terms of having a really unique build where he isn't as big as an offensive tackle, but he is a really big defensive end outside linebacker, but he moves with explosiveness. He plays with an inordinate amount of power. He is made of vibranium, is what I like to say. He throws up the Wakanda Forever sign after he makes sacks, but he is tough at the point of attack. He has a really peculiar 4-point stance that I don't like at all. I think it limits his explosiveness as a pass rusher. A lot of the times it feels like Michigan wanted him to kind of two gap and stack and control as opposed to have get off. But he's a guy who did stand at times. It felt like he had a lot more reps where he was in this strange 4-point stance as opposed to standing. But I think those are easily fixable. He is enormous. He plays with a ton of power. He corners really well. He has a rare explosiveness about him, but it feels like he plays under a ton of control. He stacks really well against the run. He's a dominant run defender. He sets the edge about as well as you're going to see out of a college prospect, in my opinion. That's why I liken him to Terrell Suggs. But despite that power, despite that size, he can win with lateral speed. He can bend around the edge. He is super duper quick. He's efficient, though, and he doesn't waste a lot of motion. He can close and he finishes. To me, he is another guy that should be getting top 10, top 15 consideration. I don't think he's going to be available outside of maybe the top 20. He overall just is riddled with strength, riddled with power in his game. He ragdolls linemen when he feels like it. He controls the edge and is a dominant run defender, as well as being able to line up over the center, over the guard, and just destroy them with quickness. He is, I feel like, has superstar potential in this draft class. Moving on, the next guy is Greg Rousseau, who gets a lot of hype coming out of Miami as well. He really only had one dominant season. It was 2019. He opted out of the 2020 season. He led the ACC in sacks with 15.5, which is a ton when you look at that number as raw number. But he kind of reminds me of Charles Omenihue coming out of Texas a couple years ago. He's about 6'6", 6'7", and he plays like he's 6'6", 6'7". He is a little bit too high at times, but knows how to use his length, knows how long he is, knows that he has to use that and how big of an advantage it is. But you don't see a lot of development as a pass rusher. You don't see, as I like to call it, pass rush, black belt, hand fighting. And you don't see him able to win cleanly. A lot of his sacks, a lot of his plays that he makes are kind of in pursuit, where he's able to dive and lunge and use his length to kind of trip a quarterback or things like that. He's a stout run defender. He can move up and down the line, but just doesn't have explosive get off. He plays a little bit high, as a lot of tall guys tend to. That's something that's fixable. He doesn't seem, I wouldn't say that he's not stiff, but I wouldn't say that it's not fixable to get him to play a little bit lower. I think he has potential as a pass rusher because of his length, because of his natural gifts. But I just don't see an explosive, quick, short space burst athlete. He was tasked with dropping back into coverage from time to time, which was interesting. It's not too often you see 6'6", 6'7" guys dropping back into coverage, but he has some straight line speed to him. He can run, but again, just not a super quick athlete. I'm not seeing him as a guy that I would be comfortable taking in the top 10, top 15. But if someone takes him in the back end of the first round, I get it. I see what you're looking at and what you're there with in terms of being able to mold him and turn him into someone that can move up and down a front, play, you know, a three tech, play a five tech, play standing outside linebacker, put him head up over a guard at a four tech thing, or head up over a tackle at a four tech, things like that. But again, just not a ton of burst, not a ton of athleticism that jumps off the page and makes you think like, wow, this guy is a guaranteed, you know, superstar. Then you think of a guy like maybe a Cam Jordan, but he's just not as refined. He doesn't have the pass rushing IQ, the quickness, but he's not really out of place. I think he's starting at a relatively high point in terms of just being able to stack and use his length and be a, you know, a guy that can step in and be in heavy rotation or take some starter snaps early on. He's not a liability against the run or anything. So kind of a guy that I've felt like I should be, you know, more impressed, and maybe his production kind of skews that because he has those raw sack numbers, but you just aren't seeing someone who jumps off the page with get off or is really threatening to dismantle tackles over and over again. But he can pursue and he can close and he uses length well. So those are good attributes. Those are most of the guys I've looked at so far. If you want to hear more on those guys, tune into the Baltimore Beatdown podcast. We will be discussing the edges at a lot more length and having an interactive listener kind of draft board we're compiling leading up to draft season. So those are some of the guys I've looked at. I still have a couple more, like I mentioned, but that does it for this week's Purple Prospect Portfolio.
Yeah, there are certainly plenty of edge players that Baltimore should be looking at in this draft. Throughout all 3 days of this draft, they could get plenty of contributors. And there are guys all around college football who are entering this draft who have the potential to be studs at the edge position. But that's all that we have for you today on Locked On Ravens. Spencer, thank you so much for joining us here again. And when we get back here next week, we'll be just over a week away until free agency begins.
Thank you so much for having me on, Kevin. Make sure to go reward Kevin for the best Ravens daily coverage in the iTunes review charts. Help the man out who gives you that great daily coverage. Thanks again, and I'll be talking to you guys next week.
Thanks so much, Spencer. When we get back here tomorrow, we'll be answering your mailbag questions. So stay tuned for that, and I will see you tomorrow.